1982, David Marsden, a pioneer investigator of movement disorders, suggested that writer's cramp was an expression of disordered function in the basal ganglia, and that the disorder was akin to dystonia. The term dystonia had long been used for certain twisting and posturing spasms of the muscles, such as torticollis. It is typical of dystonias, as of Parkinsonism, that the reciprocal balance between agonistic and antagonistic muscles is lost, and instead of working together as they should, one set relaxing as the others contract, they contract together, producing a clench or spasm. Marsden's suggestion was taken up by other researchers, most notably Hunter Fry and Mark Hallett at the National Institutes of Health, who launched an intensive investigation of task-specific focal dystonias, such as writer's cramp and musician's dystonia. But rather than thinking of these in purely motor terms, they wondered too whether rapid repetitive movements might cause a sensory overload, which could then cascade into a dystonia. At the same time, Frank Wilson, who had long been fascinated by the speed and skill of pianists' hands and the dystonic mishaps that could befall them, found himself thinking in general terms of the sort of control systems which would have to underlie the repeated, automatic performance of very fast, intricate sequences of small, precise finger movements, with the activity of agonist and antagonist muscles in perfect reciprocal balance. Such a system, involving the coordination of many brain structures, sensory and motor cortex, thalamic nuclei, basal ganglia, cerebellum, would be operating, he argued, at or close to its functional capacity. The musician in full flight, he wrote in 1988, is an operational miracle, but a miracle with peculiar and sometimes unpredictable vulnerabilities. By the 1990s, the tools had become available for a minute exploration of this question, and the first surprise, given that focal dystonia seemed to be a motor problem, was to find that cortical disturbances in the sensory system were indeed of crucial importance. Hallett's group found that the mapping of dystonic hands in the sensory cortex was disorganized both functionally and anatomically. These changes in mapping were greatest for the fingers which were most affected. With the onset of dystonia, the sensory representations of the affected fingers started to enlarge excessively and then to overlap and fuse, to de-differentiate. This led to a deterioration in sensory discrimination and a potential loss of control, which the performer, usually, would fight against by practicing and concentrating more, or by playing with more force. A vicious cycle would develop, abnormal sensory input and abnormal motor output exacerbating each other. Other researchers found changes in the basal ganglia, which, with the sensory and motor cortex, form an essential circuit for the control of movement. Were these changes caused by the dystonia, or were they in fact primary, disposing certain susceptible individuals to the problem? The fact that the sensory motor cortex in dystonic patients also showed changes on the normal side suggested that these changes were indeed primary, and that there was probably a genetic predisposition to dystonia, which might become apparent only after years of rapid, repetitive movements in adjacent muscle groups. In addition to genetic vulnerabilities, there may be, as Wilson has pointed out, significant biomechanical considerations. The shape of a pianist's hands and the way he holds them, for example, might play a part in determining whether or not, after years of intensive practice and performance, he gets a dystonia. The fact that similar cortical abnormalities can be experimentally induced in monkeys has allowed Michael Merzenich and his colleagues in San Francisco to explore an animal model of focal dystonia and to demonstrate the abnormal feedbacks in the sensory loop and the motor misfirings that, once started, grow relentlessly worse. Could the cortical plasticity that allows focal dystonia to develop also be used to reverse it? Victor Candia and his colleagues in Germany have used sensory retraining to re-differentiate the degraded finger representations. Though the investment of time and effort is considerable, and success is not certain, they have shown that, in some cases at least, this sensorimotor retuning can restore relative normality of finger movement and its representation in the cortex. A sort of perverse learning is involved in the genesis of focal dystonia, and once the mappings in the sensory cortex have gone wrong, a massive act of unlearning is needed if a healthier relearning is to occur. And unlearning, as all teachers and trainers know, is very difficult, sometimes impossible. An entirely different approach was introduced in the late 1980s. One form of botulinum toxin, which in large doses causes paralysis, had been used in tiny doses to control various conditions in which muscles are so tense or in such spasm that they can hardly be moved. Mark Hallett and his group were pioneers in the experimental use of Botox to treat musicians' dystonia, and they found that small, carefully placed injections might allow a level of muscular relaxation that did not trigger the chaotic feedback, the aberrant motor programs, of focal dystonia. Such injections, though not always effective, have enabled some musicians to resume playing their instruments. Botox does not remove the underlying neural and perhaps genetic disposition to dystonia, and it may be unwise or provocative to attempt to return to performance. This was the case, for example, with Glenn Estrin, a gifted French horn player who developed an embouchure dystonia affecting the muscles of the lower face, jaw, and tongue. Though dystonias of the hand usually occur only in the particular act of making music, this is why it is called task-specific, dystonias in the lower face and jaw may be different. Stephen Frucht and his colleagues, in a pioneer study of 26 professional brass and woodwind players affected with this type of dystonia, observed that in more than a quarter of them, the dystonia spread to other activities. This happened with Estrin, who developed disabling mouth movements not only when playing the horn, but when eating or speaking, severely disabling him in daily life. Estrin has been treated with Botox, but has stopped playing, given the danger of recurrence and the disabling nature of his symptoms. Instead, he has turned his attention to working with musicians with dystonia, a group that he and Frucht founded in 2000 to publicize the condition and help musicians who are struggling with it. A few years ago, musicians like Fleischer and Grafman, or the Italian violinist who wrote to me in 1997, might go for years without a proper diagnosis or treatment. But now, the situation has been transformed. Neurologists are much more aware of musicians' dystonia, as are musicians themselves. Recently, Leon Fleischer came to visit me a few days before he was to give a performance at Carnegie Hall. He spoke of how his own dystonia had first hit him. "I remember the piece that brought it on," he began, and described how he had been practicing the Schubert Wanderer Fantasy for 8 or 9 hours a day. Then he had to take an enforced rest. He had a small accident to his right thumb and could not play for a few days. It was on his return to the keyboard, after this, that he noticed the fourth and fifth fingers of that hand starting to curl under. His reaction to this, he said, was to work through it, as athletes are often told to work through the pain. But pianists, he said, should not work through pain or other symptoms. I warn other musicians about this. I warn them to treat themselves as athletes of the small muscles. They make extraordinary demands on the small muscles of their hands and fingers. In 1963, however, when the problem first arose, Fleischer had no one to advise him, no idea what was happening to his hand. He forced himself to work harder, and more effort was needed as other muscles were brought into play. But the more he exerted himself, the worse it became, until finally, after a year, he gave up the struggle. "When the gods go after you," he said, "they really know where to strike." He had a period of deep depression and despair, feeling his career as a performer was over. but he had always loved teaching, and now he turned to conducting as well. In the 1970s, he made a discovery. In retrospect, he is surprised he did not make it earlier. Paul Wittgenstein, the dazzlingly gifted and immensely wealthy Viennese pianist who had lost his right arm in the Great War, had commissioned the great composers of the world, Prokofiev, Hindemith, Ravel, Strauss, Korngold, Britten, and others, to write piano solos and concertos for the left hand. And this was the treasure trove that Fleischer discovered, one that enabled him to resume his career as a performing artist, but now, like Wittgenstein and Grafman, as a one-handed pianist. Playing only with the left hand at first seemed to Fleischer a great loss, a narrowing of possibilities, but gradually he came to feel that he had been on automatic, following a brilliant but, in a sense, one-directional course. You play your concerts, you play with orchestras, you make your records. That's it, until you have a heart attack on stage and die. But now he started to feel that his loss could be a growth experience. Suddenly I realized that the most important thing in my life was not playing with two hands. It was music. In order to be able to make it across these last 30 or 40 years, I've had to somehow de-emphasize the number of hands or the number of fingers and go back to the concept of music as music. The instrumentation becomes unimportant, and it's the substance and content that take over. And yet, throughout those decades, he never fully accepted that his one-handedness was irrevocable. The way it came upon me, he thought, might be the way it would leave me. Every morning for 30-odd years, he tested his hand, always hoping. Though Fleischer had met Mark Hallett and tried Botox treatments in the late 1980s, it seemed that he needed an additional mode of treatment in the form of Rolfing to soften up the dystonic muscles in his arm and hand, a hand so clenched that he could not open it, and an arm as hard as petrified wood. The combination of Rolfing and Botox was a breakthrough for him, and he was able to give a two-hand performance with the Cleveland Orchestra in 1996 and a solo recital at Carnegie Hall in 2003. His first two-handed recording in 40 years was entitled simply, Two Hands. Botox treatments do not always work. The dose must be minutely calibrated, or it will weaken the muscles too much, and it must be repeated every few months. But Fleischer has been one of the lucky ones, and gently, humbly, gratefully, cautiously, he has returned to playing with two hands, though never forgetting for a moment that, as he puts it, once a dystonic, always a dystonic. Fleischer now performs once again around the world, and he speaks of this return as a rebirth, a state of grace, of ecstasy. But the situation is a delicate one. He still has regular Rolfing therapy, and takes care to stretch each finger before playing. He is careful to avoid provocative, scaly music, which may trigger his dystonia. Occasionally, too, he will redistribute some of the material, as he puts it, modifying the fingering, shifting what might be too taxing for the right hand to the left hand. At the end of our visit, Fleischer agreed to play something on my piano, a beautiful old 1894 Bechstein Concert Grand that I had grown up with, my father's piano. Fleischer sat at the piano and carefully, tenderly, stretched each finger in turn, and then, with arms and hands almost flat, he started to play. He played a piano transcription of Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze, as arranged for piano by Egon Petri. Never in its 112 years, I thought, had this piano been played by such a master. I had the feeling that Fleischer had sized up the piano's character and perhaps its idiosyncrasies within seconds, that he had matched his playing to the instrument to bring out its greatest potential, its particularity. Fleischer seemed to distill the beauty drop by drop, like an alchemist, into flowing notes of an almost unbearable beauty. And, after this, there was nothing more to be said. Part 4. Emotion, Identity, and Music. Chapter 23. Awake and Asleep. Musical Dreams. Like most people, I dream of music occasionally. Sometimes I have panicked dreams that I have to perform in public music that I have never played before. But generally, in my dreams, I am listening to or playing music I know well. And though I may be deeply affected by the music while I am dreaming, when I awake, I sometimes have only the recollection that I have dreamed of music, or of the feelings that went with it, without being able to say what the music actually was. But on two occasions in 1974, it was different. I was severely insomniac and had been taking chloral hydrate, an old-fashioned hypnotic, in rather large doses. This disposed me to excessively vivid dreams, which could sometimes continue as a sort of quasi-hallucination even after waking. On one such occasion, I dreamed of the Mozart Horn Quintet, and this continued, delightfully, when I got up. I heard, as I never do with my normal musical imagery, every instrument clearly. The piece unfolded, played itself unhurriedly at its proper tempo in my mind. And then suddenly, as I was drinking a cup of tea, it stopped, vanished like the bursting of a bubble. During the same period, I had another musical dream, and this too continued into the waking state. Here, in contrast to the Mozart, I found something deeply disturbing and unpleasant about the music and longed for it to stop. I had a shower, a cup of coffee, went for a walk, shook my head, played a mazurka on the piano, to no avail. The hateful, hallucinatory music continued unabated. Finally, I phoned a friend, Orlan Fox, and said that I was hearing songs that I could not stop, songs that seemed to me full of melancholy and a sort of horror. The worst thing, I added, was that the songs were in German, a language I did not know. Orlan asked me to sing or hum some of the songs. I did so, and there was a long pause. "Have you abandoned some of your young patients?" he asked, "or destroyed some of your literary children?" "Both," I answered. "Yesterday, I resigned from the children's unit at the hospital where I have been working, and I burned a book of essays I had just written. How did you guess?" "Your mind is playing Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder," he said, "his songs of mourning for the death of children." I was amazed by this, for I rather dislike Mahler's music and would normally find it quite difficult to remember in detail, let alone sing any of his Kinder Totenlieder. But here my dreaming mind, with infallible precision, had come up with an appropriate symbol of the previous day's events. And in the moment that Orlan interpreted the dream, the music disappeared. It has never recurred in the 30 years since. In the curious intermediate states between waking and sleep, the hypnagogic state that may precede sleep, or the hypnopompic state that may follow awakening, free-floating reverie and dreamlike or hallucinatory apparitions are particularly common. These tend to be highly visual, kaleidoscopic, elusive, and difficult to remember. But on occasion they may take the form of coherent musical hallucination. Later in 1974, I had an accident requiring surgery to one leg and was hospitalized for several weeks in a tiny windowless room that did not allow any radio reception. A friend brought me a tape recorder along with a single cassette of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. I played this constantly, dozens of times a day, and one morning, in that delicious hypnopompic state that follows waking, I heard the Mendelssohn playing. I was not dreaming, but fully aware that I was lying in a hospital bed and that my tape recorder was by my side. One of the nurses, I thought, must have put it on as a novel way of waking me up. Gradually, I surfaced, the music continuing all the while, until I was able to stretch out a sleepy hand to turn the recorder off. When I did this, I found that the machine was off. In the moment of realizing this and being startled into full wakefulness, the hallucinatory Mendelssohn abruptly ceased. I had never experienced coherent, continuous, perception-like music in hypnagogic or hypnopompic states before this, nor have I since. I suspect that it was a combination of events that tipped me into hearing music in this way. The almost non-stop exposure to Mendelssohn, which had supersaturated my brain, plus the hypnopompic state. But after speaking to a number of professional musicians about this, I find that intensely vivid musical imagery, or quasi-hallucination, is not uncommon in such states. Melanie Challenger, a poet who writes libretti for operas, told me that when she wakes from her afternoon siesta and is in a borderline state, she may experience very loud, very vivid orchestral music. It is like having an orchestra in the room. She is perfectly aware at such times that she is lying in bed in her own room and that there is no orchestra, but she can hear all the individual instruments and their combinations with a richness and a realness that she does not have with her ordinary musical imagery. She says that it is never a single piece that she hears, but a patchwork of musical fragments and musical devices stitched together, a sort of kaleidoscopic playing with music. Nonetheless, some of these hypnopompic fragments may stick in her mind and play an important role in her subsequent compositions. With some musicians, however, especially if there has been long and intensive incubation of a new composition, such experiences may be coherent and full of meaning, even providing the long-sought-after parts of a major composition. Such an experience was described by Wagner, who wrote of how the orchestral introduction to Das Rheingold came to him, after long waiting, when he was in a strange quasi-hallucinatory twilight state. After a night spent in fever and sleeplessness, I forced myself to take a long tramp the next day through the hilly country, which was covered with pine woods. It all looked dreary and desolate, and I could not think what I should do there. Returning in the afternoon, I stretched myself, dead tired, on a hard couch, awaiting the long-desired hour of sleep. It did not come, but I fell into a kind of somnolent state, in which I suddenly felt as though I were sinking in swiftly flowing water. The rushing sound formed itself in my brain into a musical sound, the chord of E-flat major, which continued, re-echoed in broken forms. These broken forms seemed to be melodic passages of increasing motion, yet the pure triad of E-flat major never changed, but seemed, by its continuance, to impart infinite significance to the element in which I was sinking. I awoke in sudden terror from my doze, feeling as though the waves were rushing high above my head. I at once recognized that the orchestral overture to the Rheingold, which must have long lain latent within me, though it had been unable to find definite form, had, at last, been revealed to me. I then quickly realized my own nature. The stream of life was not to flow to me from without, but from within. Ravel noted that the most delightful melodies came to him in dreams, and Stravinsky said much the same. But there is no more poignant example of this than the one Berlioz provided in his memoirs. 2 years ago, at a time when my wife's state of health was involving me in a lot of expense, but there was still some hope of its improving, I dreamed one night that I was composing a symphony and heard it in my dream. On waking next morning, I could recall nearly the whole of the first movement, which was an allegro in A minor in 2-4 time. I was going to my desk to begin writing it down when I suddenly thought, if I do, I shall be led on to compose the rest. My ideas always tend to expand nowadays. This symphony could well be on an enormous scale. I shall spend perhaps 3 or 4 months on the work. I took 7 to write Romeo and Juliet, during which time I shall do no articles, or very few, and my income will diminish accordingly. When the symphony is written, I shall be weak enough to let myself be persuaded by my copyist to have it copied, which will immediately put me 1,000 or 1,200 francs in debt. Once the parts exist, I shall be plagued by the temptation to have the work performed. I shall give a concert, the receipts of which will barely cover 1/2 of the costs. That is inevitable these days. I shall lose what I haven't got, and be short of money to provide for the poor invalid. and no longer able to meet my personal expenses or pay my son's board on the ship he will shortly be joining. These thoughts made me shudder, and I threw down my pen thinking, "What of it? I shall have forgotten it by tomorrow." That night, the symphony again appeared and obstinately resounded in my head. I heard the Allegro in A minor quite distinctly. More, I seemed to see it written. I woke in a state of feverish excitement. I sang the theme to myself. Its form and character pleased me exceedingly. I was on the point of getting up. Then my previous thoughts recurred and held me fast. I lay still, steeling myself against temptation, clinging to the hope I would forget. At last I fell asleep, and when I next awoke, all recollection of it had vanished forever. Chapter 24. Seduction and Indifference. There is a tendency in philosophy to separate the mind, the intellectual operations, from the passions, the emotions. This tendency moves into psychology, and thence into neuroscience. The neuroscience of music in particular has concentrated almost exclusively on the neural mechanisms by which we perceive pitch, tonal intervals, melody, rhythm, and so on, and until very recently has paid little attention to the affective aspects of appreciating music. Yet music calls to both parts of our nature. It is essentially emotional, as it is essentially intellectual. Often when we listen to music, we are conscious of both. We may be moved to the depths, even as we appreciate the formal structure of a composition. We may, of course, lean to one side or the other, depending on the music, our mood, our circumstances. Dido's lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas is heartbreaking, tender emotion incarnate. The art of fugue, on the other hand, demands extreme intellectual attention. Its beauty is of a sterner, perhaps more impersonal kind. Professional musicians, or anyone practicing a piece of music, may sometimes have to listen with a detached, critical ear to ensure that all the minutiae of a performance are technically correct. But technical correctness alone is not enough. Once this is achieved, emotion must return, or one may be left with nothing beyond an arid virtuosity. It is always a balance, a coming together, that is needed. That we have separate and distinct mechanisms for appreciating the structural and the emotional aspects of music is brought home by the wide variety of responses and even dissociations that people have to music. There are many of us who lack some of the perceptual or cognitive abilities to appreciate music, but nonetheless enjoy it hugely and enthusiastically bawl out tunes, sometimes shockingly off-key, in a way that gives us great happiness, though it may make others squirm. There are others with an opposite balance. They may have a good ear, be finely sensitive to the formal nuances of music, but nevertheless do not care for it greatly, or consider it a significant part of their lives. That one may be quite musical, and yet almost indifferent to music, or almost tone-deaf, yet passionately sensitive to music, is quite striking. While musicality, in the sense of one's perceptual abilities, is probably hardwired to a considerable extent, emotional susceptibility to music is more complex, for it may be powerfully influenced by personal factors as well as neurological ones. When one is depressed, music may go dead on one, but this is usually part of an overall flattening or withdrawal of emotion. What is clear and dramatic, though fortunately rare, is the sudden and isolated loss of the ability to respond to music emotionally, while responding normally to everything else, including the formal structure of music. Such a temporary extinction of emotional response to music can occur after a concussion. Lawrence R. Friedman, a physician, told me of how he was confused and disoriented for 6 days following a bicycle accident, and then experienced a specific indifference to music. In a subsequent article about this, he observed, "There was one thing I noticed in the early days at home that disturbed me greatly. I was no longer interested in listening to music. I heard the music, I knew it was music, and I also knew how much I used to enjoy listening to music. It had always been the primary unfailing source that nourished my spirit. Now it just didn't mean anything. I was indifferent to it. I knew something was very wrong. This loss of emotional reaction to music was very specific. Dr. Friedman noted that he felt no diminution of his passion for visual art after his concussion. He added that since writing about his experience, he had spoken to two other people, both musicians, who had had the same experience after a head injury. Those who experience this peculiar indifference to music are not in a state of depression or fatigue. They do not have a generalized anhedonia. They respond normally to everything except music, and their musical sensibility usually returns in days or weeks. It is difficult to know exactly what is being affected in such post-concussion syndromes, for there may be widespread, if temporary, changes in brain function, affecting many different parts of the brain. There have been a number of anecdotal reports of people who, following strokes, have lost interest in music, finding it emotionally flat, while apparently retaining all of their musical perceptions and skills. It has been suggested that such losses or distortions of musical emotion are more common with damage to the right hemisphere of the brain. Occasionally, there is not so much a complete loss of musical emotion as a change in its valence or direction, so that music which previously delighted one may now arouse an unpleasant feeling, sometimes so intense as to produce anger, disgust, or simply aversion. One correspondent, Maria Ralescu, described this to me in a letter. My mother recovered from a 6-day coma after a head injury to the right side of the brain and started the process of relearning with enthusiasm. When she was moved from the ICU to a hospital room, I brought her a small radio because she had always listened to music with a passion. But after the accident, while in hospital, she adamantly refused to have any kind of music on. It seemed to annoy her. It took a couple of months for her to finally appreciate and enjoy music again. There have been very few detailed studies of such patients, but Timothy Griffiths, Jason Warren et al., have described how one man, a 52-year-old radio announcer who suffered a dominant hemisphere stroke with a transient aphasia and hemiplegia, was left with a persistent alteration in auditory experience. He was in the habit of listening to classical music and had derived particular pleasure from listening to Rachmaninoff preludes. He experienced an intense, altered state of transformation when he did this. This emotional response to the music was lost following the stroke and remained absent during the period of testing between 12 and 18 months after the stroke. During this period, he was able to enjoy other aspects of life and reported no biological features of depression. He had noticed no change in his hearing and was still able to identify speech, music, and environmental sounds correctly. Isabel Peretz and her colleagues have been especially concerned with amusia, the loss or congenital lack of ability to make structural judgments about music. They were astounded to find in the early 1990s that some of their subjects, rendered virtually amusic by brain injuries, were nonetheless still able to enjoy music and to make emotional judgments about it. One such patient, listening to Albinoni's Adagio from her own record collection, first said that she had never heard the piece before, then commented that it makes me feel sad and the feeling makes me think of Albinoni's Adagio. Another patient of Peretz's was I.R., a 40-year-old woman who had mirror aneurysms of both middle cerebral arteries. When these were clipped, the surgery caused extensive infarctions in both temporal lobes. After this, she lost the ability to recognize previously familiar melodies and even to discriminate musical sequences. Despite these gross deficits, Peretz and Gagnon wrote in 1999, I.R. claimed that she could still enjoy music. Detailed testing supported her claim. These and other cases led Peretz to think that there must be a particular functional architecture underlying the emotional interpretation of music, an architecture which could be spared even if Amusia was present. The details of this functional architecture are being slowly worked out, partly through the study of patients who have had strokes, brain injuries, or surgical removal of parts of the temporal lobes, and partly through functional brain imaging of subjects as they experience intense emotional arousal while listening to music. This has been a focus of work by Robert Satori and his lab. See, for example, Blood and Satori's 2001 paper. Both lines of research have implicated a very extensive network involving both cortical and subcortical regions as the basis for emotional responses to music. And the fact that one may have not only a selective loss of musical emotion, but an equally selective sudden musicophilia, as described in chapters 1 and 27, implies that the emotional response to music may have a very specific physiological basis of its own, one which is distinct from that of emotional responsiveness in general. Indifference to music's emotional power may occur in people with Asperger's syndrome. Temple Grandin, the brilliant autistic scientist I described in An Anthropologist on Mars, is fascinated by musical form and is particularly attracted to music by Bach. She told me once that she had been to a concert of Bach's 2- and 3-part inventions. I asked if she had enjoyed them. They were very ingenious, she replied, adding that she wondered whether Bach would have been up to 4- or 5-part inventions. But did you enjoy them? I asked again, and she gave me the same answer, saying that she got intellectual pleasure from Bach, but nothing more. Music, she said, did not move her to the depths, as it apparently could, she had observed, with other people. There is some evidence, indeed, that those medial parts of the brain involved with experiencing deep emotions, the amygdala in particular, may be poorly developed in people with Asperger's. It was not only music that failed to move Temple deeply. She seemed to experience a certain flattening of emotion generally. Once, when we were driving together in the mountains and I remarked on them with awe and wonder, Temple said she did not know what I meant. "The mountains are pretty," she said, "but they don't give me a special feeling." And yet, though Temple seemed indifferent to music, this is not true of all people with autism. Indeed, I formed an opposite impression during the 1970s when I worked with a group of young people with severe autism. It was only through music that I could establish any contact with the most inaccessible among them, and I felt this so strongly that I brought my own piano, an old second-hand upright at the time, into the hospital ward where I worked. It seemed to act as a sort of magnet for some of these non-verbal youngsters. We move on to more uncertain ground with regard to certain historical figures who have been, by their own and others' description, indifferent or sometimes averse to music. It is possible that they were profoundly amusic. We have no evidence to either support or refute this possibility. It is difficult, for example, to know what to make of the peculiar omission of any reference to music in the work of the James brothers. There is only a single sentence devoted to music in the 1,400 pages of William James's Principles of Psychology, which treats virtually every other aspect of human perception and thought, and looking through biographies of him, I can find no reference to music. Ned Roram, in his diary, Facing the Night, observes the same striking absence in Henry James, that in none of his novels, and in none of the biographies, is there any mention of music? Perhaps the brothers grew up in a musicless household. Could lack of exposure to music in one's earliest years cause a sort of emotional amusia, as lack of language in the critical period may undermine linguistic competence for the rest of one's life? A different and rather sad phenomenon, a loss of feeling for music and much else, is expressed by Darwin in his autobiography. In one respect, my mind had changed during the last 20 or 30 years. Formerly, pictures gave me considerable and music very intense delight. But now I have almost lost my taste for pictures or music. My mind seems to have become a sort of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of fact. The loss of these tastes This curious and lamentable loss of the higher aesthetic tastes is a loss of happiness, and may possibly be injurious to the intellect, and more probably to the moral character, by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature. And we are on much more complex ground when it comes to Freud, who, as far as one can judge from accounts, never listened to music voluntarily or for pleasure, and never wrote about music, though he lived in intensely musical Vienna. He would rarely and reluctantly let himself be dragged to an opera, and then only a Mozart one, and when he did, would use such occasions to think about his patients or his theories. Freud's nephew Harry, in a not entirely reliable memoir, My Uncle Sigmund, wrote that Freud despised music, and that the whole Freud family was very unmusical, but neither of these assertions seems to be true. A much more delicate and nuanced comment was made by Freud himself, on the only occasion on which he wrote about the subject, in the introduction of The Moses of Michelangelo. "I am no connoisseur in art. Nevertheless, works of art do exercise a powerful effect on me, especially those of literature and sculpture, less often of painting. I spend a long time before them, trying to apprehend them in my own way, i.e., to explain to myself what their effect is due to. Wherever I cannot do this, as for instance with music, I am almost incapable of obtaining any pleasure. Some rationalistic, or perhaps analytic, turn of mind in me rebels against being moved by a thing without knowing why I am thus affected, and what it is that affects me." I find this comment at once puzzling and rather poignant. One wishes that Freud might have been able, on occasion, to abandon himself to something as mysterious, as delightful, and, one would think, as unthreatening as music. Did he enjoy and respond to music as a boy, when he was not committed to explaining and theorizing? We know only that he was denied the pleasure of music as an adult. Perhaps indifference is not quite the word here, and the Freudian term resistance would be nearer the mark. Resistance to the seductive and enigmatic power of music. And it may be that a similar resistance underlay Nabokov's disdainful comment that music affected him merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. For many of us, the emotions induced by music may be overwhelming. A number of my friends who are intensely sensitive to music cannot have it on as background when they work. They must attend to music completely or turn it off, for it is too powerful to allow them to focus on other mental activities. States of ecstasy and rapture may lie in wait for us if we give ourselves totally to music. A common scene during the 1950s was to see entire audiences swooning in response to Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley, seized by an emotional and perhaps erotic excitement so intense as to induce fainting. Wagner, too, was a master of the musical manipulation of emotions, and this, perhaps, is a reason why his music is so intoxicating to some and so hateful to others. Tolstoy was deeply ambivalent about music, because it had, he felt, a power to induce in him fictitious states of mind, emotions and images that were not his own and not under his control. He adored Tchaikovsky's music, but often refused to listen to it, and in the Kreutzer Sonata he described the seduction of the narrator's wife by a violinist and his music. The two of them play Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata together, and this music is so powerful, the narrator comes to think, that it can change a woman's heart and cause her to be unfaithful. The story ends with the outraged husband murdering his wife, though the real enemy, he feels, the enemy he cannot kill, is the music. Chapter 25. Lamentations, Music and Depression. Robert Burton, in The Anatomy of Melancholy, wrote at length of music's power, and John Stuart Mill found that when he fell into a state of melancholia or anhedonia as a young man, music and nothing else had the power to pierce through this, to give him, at least for a while, a feeling of pleasure and being alive. Mill's depression, it is thought, stemmed from the ruthless regime imposed by his father, who demanded incessant intellectual work and achievement from the time John Stuart was 3, while doing little to nurture or even recognize his son's emotional needs. Not surprisingly, the young prodigy had a crisis when he reached adulthood and entered a state in which nothing could give him any pleasure except music. Mill was not choosy about the music. He wanted cheerful, lively melodies, and Mozart, Haydn, and Rossini were equally to his taste. His only fear was that he might exhaust the musical repertoire and have nothing left to turn to. The continuing and general need for music, which Mill described, is distinct from the crucial effect that particular pieces of music may have at particular times. William Styron, in his memoir Darkness Visible, described such an experience when he was very close to suicide. My wife had gone to bed, and I had forced myself to watch the tape of a movie. At one point in the film, which was set in late 19th century Boston, the characters move down the hallway of a music conservatory, beyond the walls of which, from unseen musicians, came a contralto voice, a sudden soaring passage from the Brahms Alto Rhapsody. This sound, which like all music, indeed like all pleasure, I had been numbly unresponsive to for months, pierced my heart like a dagger, and in a flood of swift recollection I thought of all the joys the house had known, the children who had rushed through its rooms, the festivals, the love and work. I have had a few similar experiences myself, in which music has pierced my heart, in Styron's words, when nothing else could, especially, perhaps, in bereavement. I was passionately fond of my mother's sister, my Auntie Len. I often felt she had saved my sanity, if not my life, when I was sent away from home as a child, evacuated from London during the war. Her death left a sudden huge hole in my life, but for some reason I had difficulty mourning. I went about my work, my daily life, functioning in a mechanical way, but inside I was in a state of anhedonia, numbly unresponsive to all pleasure, and equally sadness. One evening I went to a concert, hoping against hope that the music might revive me, but it did not work. The whole concert bored me, until the last piece was played. It was a piece I had never heard before, by a composer I had never heard of, The Lamentations of Jeremiah by Jan Dismus Zelenka, an obscure Czech contemporary of Bach's, I later learned. Suddenly, as I listened, I found my eyes wet with tears. My emotions, frozen for weeks, were flowing once again. Zelenka's lamentations had broken the dam, letting feeling flow where it had been obstructed, immobilized inside me. A similar reaction to music was described by Wendy Lesser in her book Room for Doubt. She, too, lost a Lenny, in her case a beloved friend rather than a beloved aunt, where for me the releaser of emotion, the cathartic, was Zelenka's lamentations, for Lesser it was Brahms's Requiem. That performance of the Brahms Requiem had a powerful effect on me. I went to Berlin thinking I would write about David Hume there, but as the waves of music poured over me, listening with my whole body, it seemed, and not just my ears, I realized I was going to have to write about Lenny instead. I had been carrying Lenny's death in a locked package up till then, a locked, frozen package that I couldn't get at, but couldn't throw away either. It wasn't just Lenny that had been frozen. I had, too. But as I sat in the Berlin Philharmonic Hall and listened to the choral voices singing their incomprehensible words, something warmed and softened in me. I became, for the first time in months, able to feel again. When I got the news of my mother's death, I flew at once to London, to the parental house, where, for a week, we sat shiver for her. My father, my 3 brothers and I, along with my mother's surviving brothers and sisters, all sat on low chairs, nourished emotionally and physically by the continual succession of relatives and friends who brought food and memories. Very movingly, many of my mother's patients and students came to pay their respects. Everywhere there was warmth, care, love, support, a flowing and sharing of feelings. But when I returned after this week to my empty and frigid apartment in New York, my feelings froze, and I fell into what is inadequately called a depression. For weeks I would get up, dress, drive to work, see my patients, try to present a normal appearance. But inside I was dead, as lifeless as a zombie. Then one day as I was walking down Bronx Park East, I felt a sudden lightening, a quickening of mood, a sudden whisper or intimation of life, of joy. Only then did I realize that I was hearing music, though so faintly it might have been no more than an image or a memory. As I continued to walk, the music grew louder until finally I came to its source, a radio pouring Schubert out of an open basement window. The music pierced me, releasing a cascade of images and feelings, memories of childhood, of summer holidays together, and of my mother's fondness for Schubert. She would often sing his Nachtgesang in a slightly off-key voice. I found myself not only smiling for the first time in weeks, but laughing aloud and alive once again. I wanted to linger by the basement window. Schubert, and only Schubert, I felt, was life. Only his music had the secret of keeping me alive. But I had a train to catch and kept walking, and I fell into my depression again. A few days later, by chance, I heard that the great baritone, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, would be performing Schubert's Windreise at Carnegie Hall. The performance was sold out, but I joined a crowd of people outside hoping to get in and managed to buy a ticket for $100. This was a huge amount in 1973, and my earnings then were modest, but it seemed a small price to pay, as I put it to myself, for my life. But when Fischer-Dieskau opened his mouth to sing the first notes, I realized that something was terribly wrong. He was, as always, technically flawless, but his singing for some reason seemed utterly flat, horribly and completely devoid of life. All around me, people seemed to be in a raptus of attention, listening with profound and unfathomable expressions. They were simulating these, I decided, politely pretending to be moved, when they knew as well as I that Fischer-Dieskau had lost the wonderful warmth and sensibility that used to pervade his voice. I was, of course, totally mistaken, as I came to realize afterwards. The reviewers the next day agreed that Fischer-Dieskau had never been better. It was I who had become lifeless again, cocooned and frozen, so frozen this time that not even Schubert could get to me. Perhaps I was defending myself, walling myself up against feelings that threatened to be overwhelming. Perhaps, more simply, I was demanding that the music work, where experience had shown me that demanding never succeeds. The power of music, whether joyous or cathartic, must steal on one unawares, come spontaneously as a blessing or a grace, as it did when the music stole from the basement window, or when I was prized open, helplessly, by the broken-hearted eloquence of Zelenka's lamentations. "The arts are not drugs," E.M. Forster once wrote. "They are not guaranteed to act when taken. Something as mysterious and capricious as the creative impulse has to be released before they can act." John Stuart Mill wanted cheerful music, and it seemed to act as a tonic for him. But Lesser and I, both dealing with the loss of a beloved figure, had very different needs and a very different experience with music. It is not coincidental that the music, which released our grief and allowed emotion to flow again, was a requiem in Lesser's case and a lamentation in my own. This was music designed for occasions of loss and death, the only sort of music, perhaps, which could speak to our condition. The psychiatrist Alexander Stein has described his experience of 9/11. He lived opposite the World Trade Center, and he saw it hit, watched it crumple, and was caught up in the terrified crowds fleeing down the street, not knowing whether his wife was alive or dead. He and his wife were homeless refugees for the next 3 months. "During this time," he writes, "my internal world was dominated by a dense and silent pall, as if an entire mode of existence were in an airless vacuum. Music, Even the usual internal listening of especially beloved works had been muted. Paradoxically, life in the auditory sphere was in other respects heightened immeasurably, but calibrated, so it seemed, to a narrow spectrum of sounds. My ears now were attuned more to the roar of fighter jets and the wail of sirens, to my patients, to my wife's breathing at night. It was only after several months, he writes, that music finally returned as a part of life for and in me, and the piece he first heard internally was Bach's Goldberg Variations. On the recent fifth anniversary of September 11th, on my morning bike ride to Battery Park, I heard music as I approached the tip of Manhattan, and then saw and joined a silent crowd, who sat gazing out to sea and listening to a young man playing Bach's Chaconne in D on his violin. When the music ended and the crowd quietly dispersed, it was clear that the music had brought them some profound consolation in a way that no words could ever have done. Music, uniquely among the arts, is both completely abstract and profoundly emotional. It has no power to represent anything particular or external, but it has a unique power to express inner states or feelings. Music can pierce the heart directly. It needs no mediation. One does not have to know anything about Dido and Aeneas to be moved by her lament for him. Anyone who has ever lost someone knows what Dido is expressing, and there is, finally, a deep and mysterious paradox here. For while such music makes one experience pain and grief more intensely, it brings solace and consolation at the same time. Chapter 26. The Case of Harry S. Music and Emotion. Perhaps one should not have favorite patients or patients who break one's heart, but I do, and among them was Harry S. He was the first patient I saw when I came to Beth Abraham Hospital in 1966, and I saw him frequently until his death 30 years later. When I met him, Harry was in his late 30s, a brilliant mechanical engineer. He had studied at MIT, who had had a sudden rupture of a brain aneurysm while cycling up a hill. He had bled extensively into both frontal lobes, and the right was severely damaged, the left less so. He was in a coma for several weeks, and remained irreparably damaged, so it seemed, for months afterwards, months in which his wife, despairing, divorced him. When he finally left the neurosurgical unit and came to Beth Abraham, a hospital for the chronically ill, he had lost his work, his wife, the use of his legs, and a large chunk of his mind and personality. And though he began slowly to regain most of his former intellectual powers, he remained severely impaired emotionally, inert, flat, and indifferent. He would do very little by himself or for himself, but depended on others for incentive and go. He still subscribed, out of habit, to Scientific American, and would read every issue from cover to cover, as he had before his accident. But while he understood everything he read, none of the articles, he admitted, excited his interest, his wonder, any more. And wonder, he said, had been at the core of his previous life. He would read the daily papers conscientiously, taking in everything, but with an uncaring, indifferent eye. Surrounded by all the emotions, the drama of others in the hospital, people agitated, distressed, in pain, or, more rarely, laughing and joyful, surrounded by their wishes, fears, hopes, aspirations, accidents, tragedies, and occasional jubilations, he himself remained entirely unmoved, seemingly incapable of feeling. He retained the forms of his previous civility, his courtesy, but we had the sense that these were no longer animated by any real feeling. But all this would change, suddenly, when Harry sang. He had a fine tenor voice and loved Irish songs. When he sang, he showed every emotion appropriate to the music, the jovial, the wistful, the tragic, the sublime. And this was astounding, because one saw no hint of this at any other time, and might have thought his emotional capacity was entirely destroyed. It was as if music, its intentionality and feeling, could unlock him or serve as a sort of substitute or prosthesis for his frontal lobes and provide the emotional mechanisms he seemingly lacked. He seemed to be transformed while he sang, but when the song was over, he would relapse within seconds, becoming vacant, indifferent, and inert once again. Or so it seemed to most of us at the hospital. Others had doubts. My colleague, Elchanan Goldberg, a neuropsychologist especially interested in frontal lobe syndromes, was not convinced. Goldberg stressed that such patients may involuntarily echo another's gestures or actions or speech and tend to a sort of involuntary simulation or mimicry. Was Harry's singing then nothing more than an elaborate, automatic sort of mimicry, or did the music somehow allow him to feel emotions to which he normally had no access? Goldberg was uncertain about this. For myself and many others at the hospital, it was hard to believe that these emotions we saw in Harry were simulated, but perhaps that speaks to the power of music for the listener. I had similar uncertainties when I saw Stephen Wiltshire, the autistic savant I have written about in An Anthropologist on Mars. Stephen barely spoke and normally showed very little emotion, even while he was producing his extraordinary drawings. But he could sometimes, so it seemed to me, be transformed by music. Once, when we were in Russia together, we listened to the choir in the Alexander Nevsky Monastery, and Stephen seemed profoundly moved, so I thought, though Margaret Hewson, who had known him well for many years, felt that at a deeper level he was indifferent to the singing. 3 years later, as a teenager, Stephen started singing himself. He sang the Tom Jones song, It's Not Unusual, with great enthusiasm, swinging his hips, dancing, gesticulating. He seemed possessed by the music, and there was none of the stiltedness, the ticking, the aversion of gaze that he normally evinced. I was very startled at this transformation and wrote, Autism disappears, in my notebook. But as soon as the music ended, Stephen looked autistic once again. I still wonder whether the music had given Stephen access to emotions that he normally could not express, or whether what we saw was a sort of impersonation, a brilliant, but in some sense superficial, performance. In 1996, the last time I saw Harry, 30 years after his accident, he had developed hydrocephalus and large cysts in his frontal lobes. He was too ill and fragile for any surgical intervention, but, though so weak, he gathered his last bit of animation and sang for me, Down in the Valley, and Good Night, Irene, with all the delicacy and tenderness of his earlier days. It was his swan song. A week later, he was dead. Chapter 27. Irrepressible. Music and the Temporal Lobes. In 1984, I met Vera B., an elderly woman who had just been admitted to a nursing home because of medical problems, including severe arthritis and breathlessness, that made independent life increasingly difficult for her. I found no neurological problems, but I was struck by the fact that Vera was so high-spirited, talkative, jokey, and a trifle flirtatious. I did not think this was of any neurological import at the time, but just an expression of character. When I saw her again 4 years later, I observed in my notes, she shows impulses to sing old Yiddish songs, and at times a near irrepressible chutzpah. It seems to me now that she is losing her inhibitions. By 1992, this picture of disinhibition had become florid. Sitting outside the clinic, awaiting me, Vera was singing A Bicycle Built for Two in a loud voice, interlarding the lyrics with words of her own invention. In my office, she continued to sing, songs in English, Yiddish, Spanish, Italian, and a polyglot mixture that contained, I suspected, all of these, plus some of her native Latvian. When I phoned Connie Tomeno, our music therapist, she told me that Vera now tended to sing non-stop the entire day. Previously, she had not been terribly musical, Connie said, but she's musical now. It was not easy to have a conversation with Vera. She was impatient with questions and often broke off in mid-answer to sing. I did what mental testing I could, and it was obvious that Vera was basically alert and oriented to her surroundings. She knew that she was an old lady in a hospital. She knew Connie, a young maidla. I forget her name. She was able to write and draw a clock. I was not sure what to make of all this. A peculiar form of dementia, I wrote in my notes. Cerebral disinhibition has proceeded apace. This may be due to an Alzheimer-like process, though surely with Alzheimer's she would be more impaired and confused. But I cannot help wondering about other, rarer entities. In particular, I wondered whether she had damage to the frontal lobes of the brain. Damage to the lateral portions of the frontal lobes can lead to inertia and indifference, as with Harry S., but damage to the medial or orbitofrontal areas has a very different effect, depriving one of judgment and restraint and opening the way to a non-stop stream of impulses and associations. People with this type of frontal lobe syndrome may be jokey and impulsive, like Vera, but I had never heard of excessive musicality as one of its symptoms. When Vera died a few months later from a massive heart attack, I tried to get an autopsy, wondering what the brain would show. But autopsies had become rare and difficult to obtain, and I was not successful. I was soon distracted by other matters and did not think about the puzzling case of Vera with her strange and, in a way, creative disinhibition, the wild singing and wordplay that had characterized her final years. It was only in 1998 when I read a paper by Bruce Miller and his colleagues in San Francisco on the emergence of artistic talent in frontotemporal dementia, that I suddenly thought of Vera again, and realized that it was probably just such a dementia that she had had, although the emergence with her had been musical rather than visual. But if there could be emergence of visual artistic talents, why not musical ones? Indeed, in 2000, Miller et al. Published a short paper on the emergence of unprecedented musical tastes in some of their patients in the dementia unit at the University of California, San Francisco, and a longer, comprehensive paper with vivid case histories on functional correlates of musical and visual ability in frontotemporal dementia. Miller et al. Described a number of patients who showed heightenings of musical talents, or, in some cases, the startling appearance of musical inclination and talents in previously unmusical people. Such patients had been described before in an anecdotal way, but no one before had seen and followed so many patients or explored their experiences in such depth and detail. I wanted to meet Dr. Miller and, if possible, some of his patients. When we met, Miller first talked in general terms about frontotemporal dementia, how its symptoms and the underlying brain changes that caused them had been described in 1892 by Arnold Pick, even before Alois Alzheimer had described the better-known syndrome that now carries his name. For a time, Pick's disease was considered relatively rare, but it is now becoming clear, Miller pointed out, that it is far from uncommon. Indeed, only about two-thirds of the patients Miller sees in his dementia clinic have Alzheimer's disease. The remaining third have several other conditions, of which frontotemporal dementia is perhaps the most common. Unlike Alzheimer's disease, which usually manifests itself with memory or cognitive losses, frontotemporal dementia often starts with behavioral changes, disinhibitions of one sort or another. This is perhaps a reason why relatives and physicians alike may be slow to recognize its onset, and confusingly, there is no constant clinical picture, but a variety of symptoms, depending on which side of the brain is chiefly affected, and whether the damage is mainly in the frontal or the temporal lobes. The artistic and musical emergences that Miller and others have observed occur only in patients with damage chiefly in the left temporal lobe.